alive and kicking.
On News Talk.
Thanks to NTC.ie, providing professional qualifications in fitness instruction, chronic myofascial pain, neuromuscular therapy, and Pilates. NTC.ie. See who you can be.
You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. You'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up, why meditation can really help at the moment and how to do it with Dermot Whelan. Performance nutritionist Daniel Davey on the importance of keeping your fitness and nutrition on point. And could you be a surrogate for your struggling to conceive friends? We meet Becky Loftus, who did just that and now continues to help potential parents on their surrogacy journey. So what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, it's a roller coaster, isn't it? There are pockets of appreciation for life slowed down the way it has been. It's a chance to take time for lots of things that we don't always get to do, whether it's play board games with the kids, cook or bake recipes we always meant to, clearing out cupboards that have been on the long, long finger. And when you stay in that zone, it can be really positive, but obviously there are different setups for every household. Some people are social distancing alone, and there is understandable worry and anxiety, all of which is okay to feel. But I've continued limiting my access to the news, only going to reliable sources when I need necessary updates. And I've kept up things like daily exercise, getting out for a short run. I think the weather has really helped, even for the kids, to be playing out in the back garden for a big chunk of the day. And there's just something about blue skies and sunshine that brings a bit of hope. I did let the meditation slip from being an absolute non-negotiable first thing in the morning, and I really felt the lack of it. It has happened this week, but not as often as it had been in the initial days, and I really felt the lack of it. It really does help. So more of that a little bit later with Dermot Whelan. But I've been doing things like strength classes on the app Zoom. I've been doing meditation meetings. I have been having yoga classes. I've been doing voiceovers. And I've really loved how people are coming together to connect online. I think using things like that, or even FaceTiming my mum and dad, except my dad kept putting the phone up to his ear, so I've checked his ear canals very well. It does make a massive difference. I think I read online there's never been a better time to stay in because of the technology we have at our hands. And it is very true. And I listened to a couple of things this week which I found really helpful. Roz Purcell did an interview with Jerry Hussey, who's been on this show before. You'll find it on our Instagram page. And in it, he talks about what's important now and how instead of letting our thoughts run wild with the possibility of all the negative that is around us, it's best to focus on what's important right now. And by remaining focused on whether we are safe and well right at this moment, as are our loved ones, it will reduce our stress, and that in turn helps to keep us healthy. Now, obviously, there is, of course, alongside a lot of physical things that we can do. There's the health guidelines for hand washing and the social distancing, for example, the keeping an eye out for the vulnerable in your community. But there is also a duty of care for us to check in with ourselves and keep ourselves as healthy as possible. And by doing that, we're all doing our best to just keep ourselves from the stressed health system. Those working in the front line, I have to say, have not been far from my thoughts at all this week. And you might remember another guest I had on the show months back, Mo Gaudat. He wrote An Algorithm for Happiness in his book Solve for Happy. Well, one of my favourite podcasters, Elizabeth Day, called on him to discuss social lockdown, as that's what they're experiencing in the UK, and the global pandemic. And he said very similar things to Jerry Hussey: staying focused on the now, staying focused on the positive, and keeping an eye out for the vulnerable and keeping yourself well. I know it's a very privileged position to be in if you can stand and say that you are well right now. Some don't have that, like the front line I mentioned there, or the leaders or the scientists who have to look and plan for the future. But that podcast is a very reassuring listen. If you have the time, search for How to Fail by Elizabeth Day. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. So you might recall I have been working with performance nutritionist Daniel Davey on my health journey. I know, who cares now? I hardly care myself. But actually, no, I am clinging to any routine that I can at the moment and the hope that we will all return to a normal life. And it is really important at a time when our health is at the forefront of our minds and keeping well, that we keep our exercise and our nutrition in check. So myself and Daniel had an update scheduled for today. So I've invited him onto the show so he can impart some advice to us all. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, thanks for having me on, Claire.
And how have you been getting on? Obviously, your face-to-face work has also taken a dip.
Yeah, things are very, very different at the moment. So obviously I work in team sport with Dublin and Leinster, and I have my own clinic as well. So all of that has been, I think, postponed is probably just the way to put it at the moment. But we're not having any contact as staff or as a group. So it's a massive, massive change. And a lot of my energy has been redirected online and our WhatsApp groups and all that kind of thing. So it's very, very different. But I suppose to put it really simply, it's about leading your position and leading your area as well as you can under the current circumstances. And that's just what I'm trying to do.
And being so heavily involved in sport, I mean, obviously, you don't underestimate the importance of health and wellness and why we're doing everything that we're doing. But it does hurt to see sport take such a kicking, if you'll excuse the pun.
Yeah, I probably come from a slightly different position in that I see, you know, my world is that sport provides jobs, and it's not just about sport providing entertainment. So I see the connection among the group. I see the social aspect. I see what it does for people in terms of motivation and inspiration and the knock-on effect then into people's daily lives. So it actually, you know, you're talking about routines and habits. It's much more a part of what our routines are on a weekly basis than you could ever imagine. And I mean, even on a recreational level, you know, my five-a-side soccer and my, you know, the visits to the gym, every aspect of our lifestyle is changed at the moment. So, yeah, it just makes up such an important role.
Yeah, I did think on the Late Late Show, the first Late Late Show after the social distancing was put in place and the schools were closed, and Des Cahill spoke, and he said people will realise tomorrow morning when there's no GAA to go to with their kids, how much of a community sport brings. So I agree. I do look at it in that way. But I think it's good what you said. Let's just consider it all to be postponed rather than cancelled altogether. And let's talk about some of the advice then that you gave me before there was any talk of lockdown or social distancing, and the basic principles that you profess for exercise and nutrition.
Yeah, I guess being very, very simple about it again, and again, it still applies in the context of where we're at the moment. It's how do you adapt your energy and how do you adapt your nutrition depending on your goal and depending on the amount of physical activity that you're doing. So we looked at your level of physical activity, which, you know, in terms of general health is quite good, and still was quite good. What I would say, and it's very, very common, is that, you know, your nutrition and your exercise lacked a structure to achieve a specific type of goal. And that's what I tried to do when we sit down, or that's what we did. We said, OK, well, here's the framework. From an exercise point of view, you're going to get expert assistance on that. You're going to look at what are the areas within your lifestyle and what are the areas within your specific exercise routine that you need to do or to complete to achieve a certain goal. And we talk about functional movement and functional strength. So in the same kind of context, then it's like, OK, well, what does that look like in terms of your general energy intake? And what does that look like from a specific nutrient point of view? And we definitely identified, you know, you do like to eat, which is absolutely fantastic, a variety of plant-based foods, but we needed to be more specific about your protein intake and your protein timing if we were to look at you recovering well from each one of those exercise sessions. So that's it in a really simple terms.
And why do you suggest carbohydrates, fats and protein at every meal?
That's a good question. So protein is I refer to it as kind of like your bedrock of your meals, and that is for a couple of reasons. One of them is the obvious one. It's rebuilding and regeneration and maintenance of muscle mass. And that's something that we have talked a lot about and that I talk a lot about within my conversation with athletes, but also the general public. So that means that you're getting a sufficient supply of the building blocks at different points throughout the day so that you maintain muscle mass, but also it's very relevant to appetite. So protein is one of those nutrients that helps to maintain consistent energy levels, but also to kind of limit you from feeling hungry or snacking out of boredom. And, you know, very often what we find is that we eat too much food later in the evening. So protein, particularly spread throughout the day, is going to help that. The reference to each nutrient in each meal, that's simply a mixed meal. And a mixed meal is more likely to provide you with a very stable and consistent level of energy. Whereas if you're just eating carbohydrate on its own, the level of satiety or the impact on your appetite, again, is going to be affected. So what you want is for your blood sugar to rise very, very slowly and to, again, to drop quite slowly. But if you're just eating a single carbohydrate meal, you don't get that consistent, nice, really stable blood sugar.
I have noticed that if I've left one of those out, even by mistake, or say I have eggs on toast and not adding a little bit of avocado or some kind of fat in there, you will find a difference in your energy levels doing it that way than combining it. And I have really over the last 3 months been eating more food than I ever would. I don't know whether it's a female thing to want to live in scarcity and constantly think that we need to be eating less. And I presume anyone who's weight conscious or health conscious can get into that mindset. But that's not your mindset. I mean, even your book is Eat Up, and it's about, you know, increasing how you're eating and making sure you're getting in the right nutrients. And you don't advocate crazy calorie counting, weighing or restriction, and you don't spend hours slaving in a gym or a kitchen. But what you do ask for is preparation, thought and consistency.
Yeah, and I'm going to actually really, really focus in on something that you said that has been a part of our process again. That's really nice to hear, particularly in this particular conversation. And that's your light bulb moment. And your light bulb moment is just what you referenced there about how you felt after eating or leaving out a particular nutrient. So you've identified that if you eat a mixed meal, that you have noticed a difference on your energy level. Now, just to be, not overly scientific about it, but you are adding a little bit of calories from your avocado, but the difference is that you're getting a more stable response to that meal, which means that you're less likely to snack. And the overall intake of calories throughout a 24-hour period is then likely to be lower. So the framework and the reference there to you being what we call mindful about what you're eating is so critical to the process as well.
Yeah, there was one day way back when life was normal and I was driving around town and I'd kind of left lunch too long and I stopped at a salad place that I love, but I forgot our advice and I just got a salad that was basically leaves and veg. And sure, I was exhausted for the rest of the day and it went on into the next morning, I found. Even though I had a good dinner, I did find when I woke up the next morning, because I hadn't eaten properly the day before, it did feed into the next day, which then feeds into how much motivation you have for exercise. So yeah, making that connection between the food that you eat and how you feel and fueling yourself was something I heard people talk about, but I had never really got my head around. I do see, looking on Instagram, Daniel, a lot of people cooking the recipes from your book to get them through the social isolation days. It is really helping. It must be nice for you to see people giving all the thumbs up and the healthy food being cooked.
Yeah, I'm going to go back again to what you said, because you've got some really important messages there. I again, very, very, very impressive information coming, Claire. And it's so nice to hear people reflecting, but also it really highlights how the answers are within ourselves. And very often, all I'm doing is providing you with the ability to reflect. That's really all I'm doing. And it's not It's difficult for people to understand that process, but it's unbelievably powerful when you do it. So you've identified how one day can affect another, and that's very relevant to somebody who you're a mum, you're incredibly active, you've got a hectic lifestyle, you're trying to include activity. And if you don't have a reasonably stable structure, it absolutely can affect your sleep, it can affect your appetite, it can affect your ability to stay within that routine. And consistency is something that is talked about all the time, but it's about understanding what consistency looks like for you in your individual situation. So some really good reflections there again. Yes, it is nice to see people cooking and using nourishing ingredients and using this time productively. Absolutely. Really positive.
I have had lots of people asking me for the recipe for your breakfast bars because I keep posting that I'm making them. Can I share that or is that copyright infringement?
Oh, share away. No. Yeah.
Hopefully your publishers feel the same.
No. Honestly, like one of the things that I feel very, very strongly about is sharing. And my whole motivation is to try and get as many of these simple recipes into people's homes and make it part of their routines as possible. So share away.
Good stuff. Well, I would highly recommend the book because all the information that I'm talking about the mixed meals and about your energy and about working out how much exercise you need and how much food you should need without, as I say, crazy weighing, feeling restricted, feeling like you have to spend hours slaving away on either. Do check it out or go to davynutrition.com for lots of recipes. I must say thank you to you. I've really enjoyed working with you so far. And while, of course, it all pales in order of importance at the moment, I have really loved the education, as I say, around food. The fact that I can still fully enjoy it. There's no scarcity. And you know that I love the message that simple steps done consistently reap results. And let's hope that that happens in my very small health journey and also the nation's health journey that we have at the moment. Daniel, thank you very, very much.
Pleasure.
Coming up, Dermot Whelan on meditation, why it will help at the moment and how to do it.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Thanks to NTC.ie, providing professional qualifications in fitness instruction, chronic myofascial pain, neuromuscular therapy and Pilates. NTC.ie. See who you can be.
So one of the tools I've been banging on about for a while is meditation and wanting to embrace meditation, this being a health and wellness show. And I didn't get round to it, really, here and there, hit and miss. But in these unprecedented times, I have found it an incredible tool to have in my arsenal, and practicing it daily has really helped me. So you may recall Dermot Whelan, the broadcaster, came in to discuss meditation and his life. So I thought I'd bring him back to let him know this revelation that you're right, Dermot. It is a really good thing to do.
You should have believed me first time round, Claire.
Only when panic strikes do you start to really think straight.
Yeah, well, look, that's very human. We are all very human, and these are testing times. But, you know, that's what's known as being a crisis meditator. And we, you know, that's natural that things drop when we don't have much in our minds. But then when, you know, things start to pile up, we start to reach for the things we know will help. And meditation is definitely one of those things because it is scientifically proven to help us all. And that's why it's such a good tool.
Let's talk about the science then and why for people during these times. Because again, it's one of the things you put off because you feel you don't have time to meditate. Let's not get into the time we spend scrolling on our phones, but people have more time now. So why would we be giving the advice that if you're feeling tense, understandably, that meditation might be something that you'd bring into your day?
If you look at it this way, what's happening in the brain when you do meditate? This was the scientific study that really kind of confirmed the whole thing for me. And what happens when we meditate is that our amygdala, which is responsible for angry thoughts and fearful thoughts and anxious thoughts, that actually has been scientifically proven to shrink. About 8 years ago, they did a scientific study out of Harvard, and they got a bunch of people who had never meditated before, maybe like many of your listeners right now, and they did 30 minutes a day for 8 weeks. And over at the end of that time, they found that their amygdala had actually gotten smaller. The gray matter had actually disappeared, a lot of it. And the part of their brain that is responsible for memory and self-awareness and spatial awareness, and that, you know, logical thinking had actually gotten bigger. So it's been scientifically proven that the parts of our brain that make us anxious get smaller when you meditate. So how can we continue to have the same amount of anxious thoughts if the part of our brain that produces it isn't really there anymore? So, you know, we need our amygdala. We need it to stop us from walking out in front of cars and knowing when a threat is around. But we don't need it all day long, every day. We don't need our bodies and brains in emergency mode. So that's why meditation works.
You've a brilliant series on your Instagram at the moment, introducing people to meditation, giving loads of different advice. And I would recommend that people do check that out. But practically, how do people meditate? Well, what's your advice on a daily basis?
My advice would be to start small, you know, and try and put away all those preconceptions that you had about what meditation is. You know, it's not for people with long hair and robes or bald monks up the Himalayas. You know, and it's not the Instagram people either who, you know, look beautiful and wear white linen clothes all the time and only meditate on cliff tops. You know, it's not that. Meditation is merely, this is the simplest explanation I have for meditation. Meditation is focusing your mind on one thing. And when your mind wanders away from that thing, you gently guide your attention back. And that's it. So there's no more to know. There's no classes to go to. There's no books to read. If you can handle focusing on your breath for a couple of minutes, and each time your mind wanders away from your breath, gently guide it back. If you can do that, you're meditating. I mean, for instance, you know, on my website, dermotwhelan.com, I have a 16-second meditation. You can meditate in 16 seconds. So that's the first thing, is sort of forget everything you've heard about meditation and just remember that it's focusing your mind. When your mind wanders, you're bringing it back. The next thing I would do is make the time for it. So find somewhere quiet. It could be your bedroom. It could be your car, because I know a lot of people have difficulty finding a quiet space at home at the moment, particularly if they've got children. So just find somewhere quiet and comfortable and give yourself, start off with 5 minutes of just sitting with yourself. And that is a great place to start. And then just gently follow your breath in and follow it out. And when your mind wanders, you gently bring it back to your breath. And that's it.
I know we're living in unprecedented times and, you know, it feels strange to talk about what it was like before, but I have noticed a real shift in people's appetite for this. I mean, you announced a show, Mindful, talking about meditation. It sold out in minutes. You announce another date, it sold out in minutes. I took part in a health and wellness talk recently and Sinead Dehora, gorgeous girl, an intuitive healer, was the next guest. And part of me, foolishly, was hoping that people would take on board what she was saying. People were soaking it up. She got the most questions of anybody on the panel. People are more open to this now, aren't they? And, you know, even if you're not, it's something you should consider if you're sitting at home and you're worrying about what's going on globally.
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, it's no different to when gyms became a thing. You know, there was a long time where people didn't really bother about their physical health, you know, but over time, you know, even in the last 20 years, say, gyms have become, you know, part of the wallpaper of our towns and cities, because people now know, okay, when I don't feel my best physically, I know what to do. I know I can go to a gym, or I can do press ups, or I can watch something on YouTube. I know what to do to get my physical body feeling better. And now we're just realizing that we need to and can do the same for our minds. I don't think it's anything out, you know, ridiculously strange. I think it's becoming more normal now that we go, do you know what, I'd like to have some tools that I can reach for when I'm not feeling mentally at my strongest, you know, and that people are realizing that we don't have to be perfect all the time, because the idea of that perfection that's being sold to us through social media every single day, it's not real. And people are realizing that. They're seeing people around them suffer with stress and anxiety, and And those kinds of words are becoming very normal now. So, you know, I think it's just where we are as humans now that we just realize that there are tools we can reach for, there are resources we can reach for, and it's perfectly normal to look after our brains.
Yeah, and it works, and you will feel it. Another major question being asked at the moment is what to do with the kids during this time. And you're saying meditation, you can involve them as well.
Yeah, absolutely can. You know, and I think we forget, you know, kids are more naturally inclined to take time out by themselves, you know, than we are. And I think it's a skill that we sort of forget over time. You know, if you watch your own kids, I remember back to when you were a kid, you know, kids naturally remove themselves from company and go off on their own. I know my daughter, Rosie, who's 8, she disappears into her bedroom and sings and plays and will spend hours by herself. And then when she's feeling ready, she comes back out and interacts with other people. But whatever way our society is now, we don't allow ourselves the time to just take time out by ourselves. It's sort of considered wasting time a lot of the time, which is silly, because it's our natural recharge time, you know. So I think kids are naturally drawn to being with themselves. They're okay with their own company. And also, you know, the idea of a meditation or deep breathing, they're very open to it. So something that I would tend to do with my family, and I think it's a great thing to do if anyone's listening and is interested in kind of doing it together, because it's a really nice thing to do. You know, it's really lovely to all pile into the double bed, all get under the duvet, get nice and cozy, and then put on a guided meditation. There's tons of them on YouTube. I've got guided meditations on my website, DermotWhelan.com. There's loads of meditation apps as well you can use, like Insight Timer. I just put one on, and I guarantee you everyone will enjoy it, and everyone would be nice and relaxed. And in particular for that hyper mode that a lot of parents are experiencing at the moment with their kids, because they're so cooped up a lot of the time. It's really good at sort of smoothing those edges.
Great. Well, I like to think of families up and down the country getting into bed with Dermot Whelan. Dermot Whelan, thank you very much. You'll find his videos on dermotwhelan.com or on his Instagram page. Mind yourself and your family. Thanks, Dermot.
Thanks for meeting, Claire.
Coming up, Becky Loftus on becoming a surrogate for her struggling to conceive friends.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to NTC.ie, providing professional qualifications in fitness instruction, chronic myofascial pain, neuromuscular therapy, and Pilates. NTC.ie. See who you can be.
Now, you might recall a couple of weeks back, solicitor Tracy Horns was on the show talking about helping potential parents navigate through surrogacy. Well, after the interview aired, I got an email from my next guest, Becky Loftus. And Becky said she was delighted to hear the topic discussed because she set up Surrogacy Ireland to support couples after she herself was a surrogate for her friends. She joins me on the line now. Hello, Becky.
Hi, Claire. How are you?
And Becky, you're right. We should remove taboo, especially around the areas of struggles to conceive and miscarriage. But I would understand, too, why some people, especially the surrogate, would want to remain private. But you want it all out in the open.
Yeah, no, there's people out there that aren't ready to share their story. It is a topic that we tend to keep very private. And we'll always have some privacy around this. But because I don't mind to share my story and I know the benefit of that, I have spoke out about being a surrogate and the way that we need to kind of get our heads around it, and also that the way that we need legislation and legalities all around this as well.
So tell me your story then. Firstly, you're a mom of 4 yourself. So had you decided your family was complete?
Yeah, very much so. So I was probably in the right headspace at the time, and we were just away on a weekend with friends of ours when it was my husband that brought up the topic with them to say about had they had any more thought about children and what they thought they'd make great parents. And from that, then my offer came where I said, look, I think I would think about or consider carrying a baby for you. My only stipulation was I didn't want any kind of genetic connection, so they would have to create the embryo and then I would literally just grow it and give it back to them. And that's kind of how it came about. I suppose we were just in the right time and the stars aligned for us.
And did it literally just pop into your head right there and then, or did you just kind of quash it down at the start, or how does a thought like that actually manifest and work its way through? You literally just said it out loud at that conversation.
Yeah, so we had actually experienced secondary infertility ourselves. So we had our first child, no problem. And then when we decided to go again, we were 6 years with all the infertility process, and we ended up having to use IVF to create our twins. And then we had a surprise baby at the end. But so we had gone through that journey. We had gone through that heartache, the stress, the emotional, the physical, the financial stress of all of that. So I think that kind of played a part in my empathy and understanding people's struggles. And I just thought, you know, it was something I was aware of. I knew about surrogacy kind of in general. And yeah, it just kind of came to me at the time. I thought, you know what, look, I think I would think about it anyway. And because at the time I was in my early 40s, 41 maybe at the time. So, you know, I had to check, and I'd had two sections and four births, three pregnancies. So I needed to do a little bit of homework, but I just kind of put it out there. But so when we went home, I said to my husband, will I message them? Should I just kind of follow up? And he said, no, let them come to you if they're... So in 2 weeks later, I got the text saying, you know, remember the offer? Were you serious? This is amazing. What do you think about it? So from then, we just took it from there, really.
And did you seek legal advice? I mean, you said you sought medical advice. Obviously, you talked to your husband. But what are the next steps then?
Yeah. So, we were aware of the legalities of it. So we were aware that, and this is why surrogacy in Ireland really at the moment is happening between either close friends like us or a family member, because there is no legal structure to protect either the couple or the surrogate within Ireland. So, we knew that once the baby was born legally, because I was married, myself and my husband would be the legal parents of the child, and that you need to go through a lot of complicated steps. And these are things that we're looking to change. But a lot of steps of my husband had to sign an affidavit saying that he wasn't the father. Then the father had to say he was the father. And then it'll go through a process where he'll get full custody. And then the process will go where his partner, so, you know, in a couple, whether it be his husband or his wife, would then have to claim guardianship and then ultimately adopt the child. So it's, you know, it is complicated, but it hence why you need that trust, because at any point in the pregnancy, I could have walked away and said, look, I don't think I can give away this baby. And at any point they could have walked away and said, look, we're not ready for this. And we would have been left with, a very complicated situation. So legally, we did know what we were getting into, but we had that trust. We had that friendship of 20 years that we knew.
But there's still a worry. I mean, you often hear that families can be ripped apart by a certain reading of a will, or, you know, when a relative gets sick. So there can be personal things that can happen among family and friends that can really rock things. So, it was a risk, but you just had a good feeling about it.
There was a risk, and I suppose then it was very important, and we always said that we needed to keep lines of communication very clear, and that. So, you know, we did our best to make sure that, you know, we kept, you know, we were honest with each other and things like that. But yeah, there was a risk. There was many little risk factors, I suppose. There was a physical risk for me to go into another pregnancy in my early 40s and have another C-section. And then there was also that risk of then, you know, a destruction of a friendship possibly, or an impact on my family or their family or whatever. So, I mean, there's risks in everything, Claire, I suppose. But I just felt that what I was able to do for them kind of outweighed the smaller risks. And that's why I proceeded with it.
Yeah. And I mean, as I said, when I replied to the email, what an incredible thing to do. So to just stay focused on the positive, I think, rather than worry about all the risks, to look through the risks and discuss them, as you say, but to remain focused that this could have been a very positive experience for all of you, which of course it was. And I watched a clip of you. You were on the Late Late Show in February. Okay. And the question that always came up about, how did you know you weren't going to get attached to this baby? And you give a very good analogy about if you were asked to mind a baby for a friend who was going through surgery and recovering. I thought that was a really good way of putting it.
Yeah. So initially that was one of my questions that I had when I was doing my research, like, oh my goodness, you know, because I only had my own births, my own children experience. So, and I know on having them that the excitement, the, you know, that, you know, kind of attachment, I suppose, and things like that. So that was, so when I actually spoke to some two UK surrogates who have done it a few times, and they said to me, the journey is completely different. And it is, from right from the beginning, the get-go, this is a journey with you know, a couple who wants to create a family, and me, and I suppose ultimately my family as well. So it's a very different journey than your own. You're not getting ready in your house. You're not getting a room ready. You're not getting the cut down from upstairs. You're not picking up things in Tesco. So it really is like that. And people say, how can you give away a baby? I was never giving away a baby. I was giving back my baby. Now, in current circumstances, I think I'd like to give away some of my children at the moment, but that's another. but it is like if someone did say to you, you know, I have to go into hospital for possibly 4 to 6 weeks. I'm going through surgery. Would you mind my newborn? I don't think your initial thought would be, oh, what if I fall in love with this baby and I can't give it back? You know that's your friend's baby. You're minding it. And that's exactly how this journey felt for me. This was their baby and I literally was growing it. My kids knew, like my youngest at the time was 4. And then my twins were 5. And then my eldest was 10. And they all knew that our friends couldn't have a baby. Mommy's going to grow it and we're going to give it back. And they, you know, and kids are great. Kids are fantastic. They took it at face value. This wasn't strange. This is fine. And yeah, so the journey was really kind of, you know, intertwined with our friends who visited quite a lot. And it was their baby. And I just grew it and gave it back. And at the time of birth, I mean, there was a little bit of an uncertainty of how my emotions or my hormones or that would play. But when I saw him, my initial reaction was to look at my friends. And finally, you know, their family was created. So
it's just incredible. Were they understandably keeping an eye on you, wanting to know what you were eating? Or did they just see that you had grown 4 healthy children and kind of leave you at it?
No, there was a definitely, and this is, I suppose, when it comes to keeping open communication. And even now, I'm helping a few couples within Ireland who are looking to do surrogacy with a sibling or a friend. And we're doing that kind of facilitation of a conversation, because things like they wanted me to use different toothpaste that wasn't, you know, that didn't have any kind of e-numbers or whatever. They wanted me to use different hair products. They didn't want to get my hair dyed, my nails done. So actually they went very much, I suppose, very typical first time parents, where you Google everything and you try your best to tick all the boxes. For me, by the time the 4th came, I don't think I did anything like that.
But no, shellfish, a go-go, an unpasteurized cheese.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, donuts on the floor. Yeah, look, they're fine. Pick them up. So in this case, I did respect that, you know, because I wanted them to experience a first pregnancy as much as they possibly and physically could. So, you know, I did follow kind of, you know, their requests, you know, and they weren't, you know, if I had said to them, look, no, I'm not going to do that or whatever, I'm sure they would have respected that too. But yeah, I was fine with all those things. And like I said, we just kept up the communication and even things like we got these little belly buds that go on your tummy, and we download an app where they were able to read stories. So baby heard their voice on the little belly buds on my tummy, you know,
wow.
Doing things like that. So we tried our best to kind of make as much for them to have much, you know, communication and connection with the baby as possible.
And as the couple are friends of yours, do you still see that child? Is there a bond there at all? Or does it just feel like you're your mate's kid when they come around?
It really does, Karen. I know this is really hard for people to understand, but it really does when I, because he looks like them. So, you know, that's one thing. And yeah, it just feels, we see them kind of irregularly. Well, not at the moment, but irregularly before, because they're about an hour and a half away from us. So, and we get a little update picture sometimes or videos like you would for new parents. And that's kind of it. But there is, honest to God, there is really no maternal bond. I definitely feel, you know, very, you know, lucky that I've been a part of this journey, and I look at them, you know, and I do have a connection with them, I feel, you know, but not any sort of maternal bond or want to be involved in that sort of thing. So like I have actually one nephew. I only have one brother, and he lives in Australia. And to be honest, you know, I have more of kind of a, you know, a longing to see him or a connection with him than I would with our friend. So
that's really interesting. And as I mentioned, you've set up Surrogacy Ireland. So is this going on more than we think? I mean, recently it was all over the headlines because Rosanna Davidson very bravely shared her story and her visit to the Ukraine. And I think part of us realises that that is going on. But I don't think we realise that it's happening like your situation more often than we think, or is it?
Yeah, no, definitely at the moment. So I set up Surrogacy Ireland just really for a point of reference for people to get some information, to be kind of a body that lobbies for the legislation. So legislation has been drawn up and it is in final draft for domestic surrogacy, so going forward. So we will have similar laws and legislation as the UK, where it's altruistic surrogacy here within Ireland. That was about to go to Cabinet and then the election was called. So we're still waiting for the final kind of government to be formed. And then I will again try on behalf of kind of people who are going through this, will lobby to get that passed through. But also there's a lot of other things that need to be addressed within surrogacy. But within Ireland, yes, we do have people that are, being a surrogate for their sisters or brothers, or they have close friends. And the odd time you will have new relationships, so people will find each other on the internet, someone who wants to be a surrogate and someone looking for a surrogate. And sometimes you have those relationships. But as I said, there's risk with those, and you'd want to really make sure that relationship has been formed and understanding before anything further. But I'm actually working with probably about four groups at the moment that are looking to be used surrogates. And I'm actually speaking to fertility clinics here in Ireland and to see how they can move with the times as well and support these people who want to have surrogacy and don't have to go abroad, and whether there's a way around it, whether they can facilitate that. So they're looking into things at the moment as well. But there's a lot of couples still, if they don't have that connection with anyone or don't have anyone, they are going either America, US, or they're going eastwards, where they're going to the likes of Ukraine and Greece. And we have a lot of people at the moment that are in huge amount of worry because of the COVID-19 situation, where babies are due coming up, their due dates are coming up, and travel is being locked down. So I do know that there's Irish lawyers and that are working on behalf of those couples to see if there's any way we can support, any way they can be supported and that sort of thing.
But the ripple effect is unreal. And I mean, there's no judgment. I don't think, I wouldn't cast any judgment. I don't think there's a hierarchy on how this should be done and whether one surrogacy way is better than another. But where it's altruistic, where money is taken out of the equation, does that make it a little less complicated, or do you think sometimes it needs a financial structure?
Well, I think even if you're doing altruistic, there needs to be some financial structure with regards to expenses and what you would cover as expenses and your expectations. And that's what I suppose I'm working with couples on, where we kind of separately, they go through a list of what they would expect to pay for, what they expect to be paid for. And then I'm hopefully to facilitate that kind of, where we come up with some sort of agreement. So there needs to be some sort of structure and understanding in that, like, you know, if you need, if you have your own children, that you would need childcare and housekeeping at the end of the pregnancy and things like that. So there would have to be some type of structure. I think with regards to commercial surrogacy, as long as it's very transparent. Now, I know Tracy touched on about payments of surrogacy, but there would be now a lot of agencies that would have that transparency, even in the Ukraine, where couples are aware of what they're paying their surrogate. And in some cases, they pay them directly. They pay them directly their final fee at the end once the birth has happened. And then also they pay them a monthly fee. So with some agencies abroad, and I think that's very important if anyone is looking at surrogacy abroad, is that all fees are very transparent, and you know what your surrogate's getting, and that they're happy with that, and there's a very clear understanding, and they're being looked after and cared for. That's always my advice to people, is that you quiz your agency as much as possible, and that the care of the surrogate and how they mind them, how they screen them, how they're being paid, what they're being paid, is, I think, are very important questions, and that should be answered. And I think a lot of agencies can answer that for you, which is good. But so yeah, as long as there's transparency when it comes to finance, I think it's fine.
Well, it sounds like you've got great advice for people, and it's always best when somebody has been through an experience themselves, because they can completely empathise and share. Where can people find you?
Yeah, so I actually set up a Facebook page. It's Becky Loftus Surrogacy Ireland, and I do have a website, surrogacy-ireland.ie. And we had an event a couple of months ago, before all of this, in Athlone, where over 200 people turned up, where we had some great advice from Annette Hickey, our lawyer. We had Dr. John Kennedy from SIMS and myself there. And we are hoping to run, once everything has, we've gotten over this, that we are hoping to run some more free of information events coming up. So I'll be able to keep people posted on that as well.
Yeah, and people can
have
contact
any
you online.
Or if they want any support or anything like that, I'm free to have a chat. There's no problem with that.
Well, you are an amazing person. It is amazing what you did. And I know you're just taking it in your stride. But yeah, it's a really good thing you did and that you continue to do to support couples. It's something that is very, very tricky. Becky Loftus, thank you so, so much.
Well, thanks for having me, Claire. Mind yourself.
Amazing story there. I think Becky is an absolute inspiration, as I said to her. So that's it from Alive and Kicking for this weekend. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy. Thank you also to anyone who took the time to email me over the last few weeks or contacted me on social media, some with positive stories, some with suggestions of items we could cover on the show in the future. You're all amazing, and I've been feeling very proud and hopeful about this little country of ours. So take care of yourself this week and have a good Sunday.